This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a professor of international law says the U.S. acts like a rogue nation in the world, invading, assassinating, and launching unjust wars at will, and that includes the ultimate threat of nuclear war. We'll speak with an activist who says the Trump administration is making human extinction more likely. But first, public school teachers in cities across the country took part in a Black Lives Matter Week of Action last week. In Washington, D.C., the activities were organized by the D.C. Area Educators for Social Justice, a project of Teaching for Change. We spoke with organizer Deborah Menkart.
Black Lives Matter Week of Action grew out of Black Lives Matter actions in schools in Seattle in 2016, and then spread Seattle and Philadelphia in 2017. And then there was a group that came together and has been on a national level from various cities. It's been meeting since last fall, talking about how do we spread this as a national movement. Faye Colon, who's on our staff as a coordinator of the D.C. Area Educators for Social Justice, has joined in on those calls along with Denisha Jones, who teaches a teacher education program at Trinity. They have been participating in the national call and then started calling local meetings here in D.C. We were joined as partners by the Center for Inspired Teaching and then also received a co-sponsorship from the Washington Teachers Union and from the D.C. Public Schools Secondary Literacy Team. A group of teachers, really, who then from D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, who really shaped the plans for this week here in D.C.
We, of course, know that power concedes nothing without a demand, and you do have demands.
Yes. The design from the national effort was to both set some national demands, which are very powerful, three very powerful demands. One is to end zero tolerance, focus our schools on restorative justice. The second is Black teacher pushout ends now, hire more Black teachers in our schools. And the third is that Black history, ethnic studies be mandated K through 12. And then each local city teachers met and community members talked about also local demands. In our case in D.C., people talked about institutionalizing race and equity committees in schools, ending the over-reliance on standardized testing, and then creating more equity resources in schools today.
Most of us understand the second and third demands to end Black teacher pushout and hire more Black teachers. But what is restorative justice?
So restorative justice is that rather than suspending or expelling students, to really address internally in the school in a social justice, proactive, student-centered ways to address any concerns that are arising. So rather than punishing, really providing support and a fair approach to dealing with issues that arise.
D.C. schools are overwhelmingly Black, but I'm aware that there are schools in which there are very few Black teachers.
That's correct. As we look over time, D.C. had a majority Black teachers, and that's now we're seeing, you know, more and more white teachers being hired, and that's shifting. And that's, I think, one of the areas of focus that we have here in D.C. is to ensure that the teachers who are here are retained and that more teachers of color are hired.
And we've also noted there are public schools in D.C. in which the overwhelming number of students are non-Black, and that used to be quite rare.
That's correct. Now, that's a shifting demographics, both with teaching and student population, a result also of the gentrification here in D.C.
Well, it seems to be also by design on the part of the school system to provide some environments in which white students and white teachers are dominant.
It's very possible. I'm not sure exactly what the school system is planning, but I certainly know that unless we plan intentionally to create not just diverse but equitable schools throughout the system, that it won't happen. It takes intentional effort to counter the national direction, the inequity that exists in our society at all levels.
Well, you were successful in getting this Black Lives Matter week, so there must be some level of cooperation that's been established with the school powers that be.
Absolutely. There are, as there have been for many years, people within the school district, certainly in our case right now, working with the secondary literacy team, who are focused on the social justice curriculum, the teachers' union, as we know many teachers, administrators, parents throughout the school system, who are concerned that children not just learn to read and write, but also change the world and create the kind of world that we all need for our future. So within D.C., there's been a lot of support and interest and actually excitement about pushing, really focusing on the curriculum so that it's not when we're particularly right now during Black History Month that it's going beyond a Heroes and Holidays approach to really addressing the issues that are impacting children's lives and their future.
And what's been the level of excitement and interest among the students?
Incredible. In fact, a lot of the students are saying this is the kind of curriculum that we want to see all year long, which is, of course, what one would hope is that once it gets introduced during this week, that it becomes a norm for the rest of the year. We've had curriculum fairs. There were two curriculum fairs getting ready for this week where teachers could pick up books that were appropriate for the age level of the students they were working with, share ideas. The lessons are for language arts, for math, for science, for social studies. So it's been a way to infuse this content throughout the curriculum.
Well, this kind of activity certainly does fly against the grain of the Trump administration.
Yes, it's exactly why the right wing has paid a lot of attention to what children are learning, pre-K through 12. And in fact, this morning I can pull up here, we just got a Google alert. There was an article that came out that said that Teaching for Change, the group that I work with, is promoting Marxism in schools. So any attempt to teach the truth, there's immediate red baiting and an attempt to shut it down. But thankfully, there's a lot of teachers who are committed to bringing in curriculum that reflects not just the identity and the representation of children, but also the reality that they face on a daily basis and helps them learn. For example, yesterday we had a SNCC veteran from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Cortland Cox, speaking at Columbia Heights Educational Campus to high school students and talking about the fact that the movement wasn't just one individual, wasn't just Dr. King or Rosa Parks, but it was a whole movement of hundreds of people, thousands of people who were just their age when they took action against the restrictions of voting rights and against segregation and the violence that permeated. So this is an attempt absolutely to counter the dominant narrative in the curriculum and to tell the truth. If teachers are, any listeners are looking for resources, they can visit our website, teachingforchange.org, because the resources that were compiled really by teachers throughout the D.C. metro area for this week are relevant for the entire year. Most of the lessons that are posted online are free and downloadable. The children's books are great for the classroom, great for anyone to read with young people. And we've really seen that having this week of action has helped deepen both the dialogue and the instruction about issues of race and racism in this country's history. And we really so appreciate the work of teachers to step up on top of everything else they're doing to do all the preparation that was involved for this week.
That was Deborah Menkart of Teaching for Change in Washington, D.C. U.S. forces attacked and claimed to have killed about 100 Syrian soldiers. Syria and Russia are warning that the U.S. is playing with fire and has no right to station soldiers on another country's territory. But the fine points of international law don't seem to matter to Washington. We called Dr. Francis Boyle, the esteemed professor of international law at the University of Illinois at Champaign.
If you read the statements coming out of the Pentagon, they're saying, well, this attack on Syrian forces in Syria is legitimate self-defense, which is pure bulltwaddle. We have no legal authority to have invaded Syria in the first place, especially against the wishes of the Syrian government. And indeed, not that long ago, a general let slip that we really have about 4,000 troops in Syria, not the currently reported 2,000. So it's clear we are there to stay. Indeed, they've now admitted we're not leaving Syria anytime soon. ISIS was just a pretext to get us into Syria as it was a pretext to get us back into Iraq after Obama had pulled us out pursuant to the Bush Jr. agreement with our puppet government in Iraq. And we've also made it clear we're not leaving Iraq anytime soon. Of course, Iraq has all that oil. And at least Trump was honest, saying we're in Iraq to steal their oil. As for Syria, you'll note this is taking place right near the major Syrian oil fields. So, of course, we're there to hold on to those oil fields and to keep the legitimate government of Syria from regaining control of those oil fields from these terrorist jihadi groups that we have armed, equipped, supplied, trained, and funded. And then second, our position in Syria is also directed against the Assad government. We have no right to be overthrowing the Assad government one way or the other. And Tillerson just called for this again. It's clearly illegal. And then second, as a pivot against Iran, we are right there in the middle against Iran as well. And you'll note the neocons used to say that the real men go to Tehran. And that's what this is all about. So it's putting us in there. As for these Kurdish forces that we are supporting, we've helped them take over about 30% of Syria. Israel is over there working hand in glove with the Kurdish forces to establish a de facto Kurdish state in order to carve up Syria pursuant to their Yinon plan, which is basically to carve up all the states of the Middle East into little bitty pieces so that Israel can better control and dominate the surrounding Arab states. So that's the real agenda here, Glenn, and everything you're reading in the mainstream news media is pure pro-Pentagon, pro-State Department propaganda.
I remember very well how there were reports of military men in Syria and around Washington and the Pentagon talking about what was necessary in Syria was that some Russians come back in body bags.
That's correct. It's extremely dangerous, Glenn. As you know, this Soviet jet fighter was shot down and the pilot was killed by means of man pads. The Russians have said they're engaging in an investigation here, but obviously it's already been reported. We smuggled man pads from Libya through Turkey and into these terrorist jihadi groups in Syria. So I'm afraid the Russians might come back after their investigation and say, yeah, these were man pads given to America's terrorist jihadi groups, and they just killed one of our pilots and shot down one of our jets, and things could get a lot worse between you and me. You have U.S. forces over there. Turkey is now invading Syria to carve out its own imperial domain. You know, the Ottoman Empire is back, and they're going back and stealing more land. Iran is there. Hezbollah is there. We're there. Russia is there. So anything could go wrong, and, you know, you could have a clash, certainly, between Russia and the United States. It appears we very well might have with the shooting down of this Russian jet if the Russians come back and say that man pad was provided to the terrorist jihadis by us. So we'll have to see what happens there. I really don't know.
It was not that long ago that the Syrian Kurds, as opposed to the Kurds in Iraq, who do have a long relationship with Israel and the United States, but the Syrian Kurds had an understanding with the Syrian government and were fighting a common foe, that is, ISIS, before the United States became the main armor of the Kurds in Syria.
Well, that's correct. And now these Kurdish forces that we are supporting control about 30% of Syria. And it's clear we are encouraging them, certainly, to set up a de facto independent state and, you know, effectively carve up and partition Syria, just as we've done to Iraq. Iraq today only exists as a state in name, after all these years of war that we have inflicted upon them, going back to 1991, they've pretty much been carved up and partitioned. And all the Zionists here in the United States and the neoconservatives, pretty much the same thing, support that on behalf of Israel, carving up and destroying the strong nationalistic Arab states like Iraq, like Syria, that would not do the bidding of Israel and the United States. And of course, Libya, they've destroyed Libya too. It no longer functions as a state. It's been carved up and destroyed.
The United States sounds like it's talking out of opposite ends of its mouth. It goes on and on about how, because of the U.S., ISIS has been all but annihilated, and then at the same time says that the United States has to stay in Syria indefinitely because of the threat of ISIS.
Right, and they're saying the same thing about Iraq, too. But the bottom line is, ISIS was just a pretext, as I said, to get us back into Iraq and also now to get us for the first time into Syria. And a lot of these ISIS people were our people. It was just Al-Qaeda transformed into ISIS. They changed their name. So we've really been behind these terrorist groups, both in Iraq and Syria, and using them as a pretext now for continued U.S. military occupation in Iraq, in Syria, to steal oil, which Trump himself has publicly admitted, and also as a bastion and an outpost against Iran for whenever the CIA, military, neocons, Trump decide to go after Iran. So we'll have military forces there already.
And now we have the Turks inside Syria. They claim to be in alliance with what they call the Free Syrian Army. But we all know that the Free Syrian Army, as a separate and distinct entity, does not exist. And most of those Arab fighters are, in fact, jihadists affiliated with some variation of Al-Qaeda or ISIS.
And as a matter of fact, as you know, we helped and Europe helped smuggle in large numbers of these jihadi terrorists through Turkey. That's where they came from Europe and the United States, helped them all come in there. So they're just working with the people they've been working with all along. But again, this is the Ottoman Empire all over again. They want to take off a slice of Syria, indeed. The President Erdogan just said, I guess this week now, that yes, after World War I, the Allies stripped us of this land from the Ottoman Empire, and now we're coming back. So that, I think, is the real objective here, yes.
Yes, Turkey talks about restoring those parts of Syria that it's attacking and then occupying, restoring it to its rightful owners, whoever that is.
Right. As I said, this is the Ottoman Empire reconstituting itself at the expense of Syria, which, yes, Syria, before the First World War, used to be part of the Ottoman Empire. And because the Ottoman Empire fought on behalf of Germany and the Central Powers during the First World War, its empire was dismantled, and leading the solid core of Turkey, which they have today. So, you know, empires never forget. They have short memories. And I believe Erdogan, and it looks like most of Turkey supporting this invasion, are behind reconstituting an Ottoman Empire to the extent they can get away with it at the expense of Syria.
Well, yes, and also possibly in contradiction to the U.S. worldview. The U.S. empire thinks that means the entire planet.
That's right, Glenn. If you read the national security strategy put out by the Pentagon, it basically calls for us to wage war all over the world whenever we want to. There's no limit at all. It's just world conquest and domination as we see fit, right? And if you read through that, there's no conception of the requirements of the United Nations Charter or international law, or the approval of Congress for any of this, as required by the War Powers Clause of the United States Constitution. and the War Powers Resolution. It's simply imperialism run amok all over the world, including now Latin America as well. You know, we're down there threatening Venezuela, as well as Africa. This is like the Berlin Conference all over again, where Europe set off the scramble for Africa. And this time, France, Germany, the United States, Britain, it's a new scramble for the resources of Africa at the expense of the people living there. Sure.
In Syria, the United States, when it even bothers to cite international law, claims that its presence is justified because there was a Security Council resolution calling upon all of the world's people to fight against ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and that this justifies the U.S. presence in Syria.
That resolution never authorized the use of military force anywhere. The Security Council is quite explicit when it comes to the authorization of military force. Not that I support some of the authorizations that they have approved, but there was no explicit authorization for the United States to use military force here. None. It's not there. They just pull this out of thin air and use whatever bogus legal pretext they can come up with.
So even this fig leaf is an illusion.
Well, certainly it is. But the problem is, all they really care about, Glenn, is coming up with some bull twaddle propaganda that they can sell to the American people by means of the mainstream news media, which they completely control. So if you look at any of the mainstream news media, and I spend my career doing this, do you hear any anti-war voices raising any of these considerations? No, not on TV, not the New York Times, not the Washington Post, not the Wall Street Journal. I get all three of them. And then ABC, NBC, CBS, MSNBC, CNN, Fox. There's not a dissenting voice there. On U.S. imperialism abroad, it's sort of like what Chomsky and Herman said in Manufacturing Consent, the Vietnam War, that the U.S. mainstream news media basically works like a Wurlitzer organ for whatever propaganda is coming out of the Pentagon and the State Department. So, we've been through this before on Vietnam.
Yes, CNN and the rest almost never independently even raise the question of international law, much less call upon experts like yourself to explain international law.
Right, and they don't even raise the questions of U.S. constitutional law and the War Powers Resolution. They just assume whatever president in power, whether it was Obama, who was behind me at Harvard Law School and knew better, or Trump, who's not a lawyer, decides to wage war, they just hop to it and produce whatever is the party line. And it is interesting, as I said, Obama was behind me at Harvard Law School. If you go back and look at all the statements he made when he was running for the presidency, they were all impeccable. But once he became president, he violated every statement he ever made about war powers and the Constitution and international law. So, I don't know what you think of Trump, but certainly Obama knew better and he didn't care less.
And he's no longer president, but he has not amended his presidential position on any of these foreign policy areas.
No, he never has. And now he's setting up this institute there at the University of Chicago, my dis alma mater, where I was an undergraduate. And that's the center up there for the neoconservatives. So Obama will fit right in. The Straussian neoconservatives are all up there at the University of Chicago, where, by the way, Obama, he was a lecturer there in the law school where he came in contact with these people. So he'll be just fine there with the neoconservatives. And of course, destroying a good part of the black community up there in the south side of Chicago in order to produce the Obama mausoleum. And the black community is up there quite upset as to what his plans are and in his golf course there with Tiger Woods. It's pretty astounding, but there it is.
So there's little prospect of Barack Obama following the lead of Jimmy Carter and becoming more mellow in his non-presidency.
He's out there trying to make as much money as he can, Glenn, by kissing up to Wall Street and the bankers and insurance companies and everyone else who will pay him. So, of course, he's not going to turn into a Jimmy Carter type. And, you know, between you and me, after 8 years of lies by Obama, I wouldn't believe anything he had to say. And we even had the same jurisprudence teacher at Harvard Law School, Roberto Unger, the founder of the Critical Legal Studies movement. And Unger has repeatedly said of Obama, quote, "Obama is a disaster," unquote. He said that on the BBC and other places. And, you know, I agree with Professor Unger, sure.
Dr. Francis Boyle, professor of international law at the University of Illinois. The Trump administration is moving forward with former President Barack Obama's plans for a $1 trillion makeover of the U.S. nuclear arsenal. The administration's views on nuclear war can be discerned in the recently released Nuclear Posture Review. Greg Mello, executive director of the Anti-Nuclear Weapons Los Alamos Study Group, has read the document, and he finds it very scary. But Mello notes that it was President Obama who was determined to create an adversarial relationship with the Russians.
President Obama kind of talked left and cut right. The 2010 Obama Nuclear Posture Review made some dovish sounds, and I think that we could discuss at length how sincere they were, but it really doesn't matter. By the end of his administration, he had committed to a very large investment in nuclear weapons and hardly any nuclear disarmament. And within his administration, Russia phobes and hawks were gradually gaining ground until by the end, it was all he could do to either wash his hands of some issues or try to restrain in a few places. So his policies ended up far more hawkish than his nuclear posture review. That's the place where Trump started. Trump's nuclear posture review takes that and adds more small usable nuclear weapons. The idea, which was always implicit, that the United States might use nuclear weapons in a conventional conflict up to that point, that's always been there. But Trump has kind of highlighted that and put some proposals for more usable nuclear weapons in there because they're terribly Russophobic and they're very concerned about the loss of power of the U.S. empire. And they think that nuclear weapons can somehow be a winning weapon.
Yes, Trump is talking about nuclear retaliation for cyber attacks.
I think that for a lot of Americans, they haven't been really aware of what a potential first use policy of nuclear weapons really entails. It means using nuclear weapons because a non-nuclear attack has occurred somewhere, either attack on the United States of some nature, like a cyber attack, or an attack on U.S. troops somewhere where they might lose, or U.S. ships. So that's always been there, but Trump has showcased it to an alarming degree.
Yes, the U.S. has never forsworn first strike. And in fact, standard U.S. nuclear posture back in the day was to respond in nuclear fashion if there were a massive conventional Soviet attack in Western Europe.
Exactly. And the basic idea remains the same. The circumstances are a little different. The cyber attack has somewhat taken the place of an attack in Europe, although I suppose an attack in Europe is back on the table because we are very much creating mischief wherever we can in the immediate area of Russia, especially Ukraine right now.
Yes, in today's world, the Russians, not Soviets anymore, would only have to cross their own border to confront NATO.
Correct. We just kept expanding NATO. It started with a Democrat, Bill Clinton, in second term, and it's gone on ever since. And Russia feels very much cornered. They don't like to see panzer divisions on their western border, which was intentionally done to send a signal. You know, that's the kind of thing that these neoconservatives that are scattered throughout government and in high places people have told me that they just love that. They just want to do things to drive Russia crazy.
I'm a senior citizen, and all of my life, the Republicans have been considered the more hawkish, but that has changed.
Absolutely, it has. And I feel the same way, Glenn, and it's kind of, it's something we talk about and try to deal with all the time, at how liberals, progressives have become manipulated to be the tacit allies of the military-industrial complex in vilifying Russia, which has no factual basis. And of all the things that we should be working on, the justice issues, the climate change, making sure that we have a social contract in this country, for some reason, we're mobilizing to vilify Russia and protect the FBI of all things. We don't have any real organized senior level Democratic Party opposition to war at this point.
And that includes Bernie Sanders, who has very little to say about foreign policy. And when he does speak, he's hawkish as well.
That's quite true. I saw an essay not too long ago, just a few days ago, that has been rolling around in the back of my mind, that some of our progressive leaders are in many ways like liberal Republicans of the 1950s, like Eisenhower. And I haven't really assessed the full truth of that or absorbed it, really, but I know there is at least some truth to that, if not a lot.
Well, certainly the alliance between the top of the Democratic Party, as personified by Hillary Clinton, became evident in the campaign with the CIA and other intelligence operatives becoming quite politicized in their support for the Clinton candidacy.
Totally true. And this phenomenon is very new to our experience, where there's no check right now, no real check or balance. We've got a very short-circuited connection between the dominant media and ex-government officials and the intelligence agencies, so that these, like CNN, New York Times, Washington Post, become almost stenographic in their relaying of messages from deep state, if you want to use that term, the permanent foreign policy elite in the country. And there's a feedback that's going on from those media back to Congress. People are very busy. They don't have a lot of time to listen to and weigh alternative media. They read the New York Times and Washington Post while they're rushing to a midnight vote. So they think they know a lot of things which they don't know, which are not really true. So you've got Trump's volatility, and the people around him are, many of them, neoconservative, not all. And then the generals, which are all too prominent in this administration. And then on the other side, you have what? You have mild rebukes of nuclear policy, but, you know, really basically Democrats support about 90% of it. So there isn't really an opposition. And I'm hoping that we can all wake up before we pass watershed moments where it's much more difficult.
What kind of impact has this new nuclear posture had on Russian policy and pronouncements?
That's a very good question. And the idea of the authors is that Russia will essentially back down, that some of the worst parts of the nuclear posture review are fashioned as explicitly as bargaining chips, so that we would drop these ideas if Russia dropped, say, the caliber nuclear cruise missile, which could carry nuclear weapons. But it really isn't seen this way in Russia. Russia doesn't have the policy about nuclear weapons, which the nuclear posture review says it has. From the Russian perspective, they would only use nuclear weapons if they felt that their country was on the verge of being annihilated. So they feel that the ultimate goal of U.S. policy is some kind of regime change or degradation of sovereignty in Russia, which I think is correct. Henry Kissinger even said as much when Obama was in power. And so they would use nuclear weapons only if they felt the very existence of their country was at risk, which is very similar to the United States perspective. In that case, they're not going to back down because we have an exact comparable nuclear weapon to theirs. It's just a fallacious idea, but one that happens to generate tens of billions of extra dollars to the nuclear weapons industries and probably hundreds of billions for the defense industry in general.
You say that the goal, and that would be a bipartisan goal, is to break Russia. I suppose these folks think that they broke the Soviets and they can do it again with the present folks in the Kremlin.
Yes, I think that's correct. My conversations with people, including in the Obama White House, have left me with that strong impression. I think there's a whole generation of senior people in the Democratic Party who cut their teeth during the Clinton years, which is a fairly long time, that think that the normal state of the world is that the United States is basically in charge of Russia, and it's a less than fully sovereign country. And the prospect of Russia being fully sovereign, you know, it's stretching from Eastern Europe all the way to the Pacific, from the Arctic to the Middle East, that is so horrifying to the neoconservatives that they feel that something has to be done, and that something is subjugation of Russia. But that is not going to happen.
And we've only been talking about Russia and the United States, but there are other nuclear powers, China, India, Pakistan, Israel, and of course the U.S. allies, France and Britain.
Absolutely. Some of what's in the Nuclear Posture Review is certainly related to the rise of China. The RAND Corporation did a study which only confirms what the person on the street would think as well, that Chinese military power is growing. The United States is not guaranteed to prevail in China in a war. So this also causes panic. And when arguing with people in Washington about whether to develop a new nuclear-tipped cruise missile, which is an Obama plan, the answer I got from an assistant secretary of defense was, well, we don't want Japan or South Korea to develop their own nuclear weapons, so we better do this to defend that region against China. That implies defending someone with a nuclear cruise missile implies a willingness to use it.
We all know that the military and politics are inextricably intertwined, but I get the impression that you believe that the U.S. nuclear posture is based much more on politics and ideology than on the science behind nuclear weapons and the science behind the livability of the planet.
It's a totally political document, ideological document. You know, the original drafters, people whose name was on the original drafts, were Keith Payne from the National Institute of Public Policy, who was very hard right ideologue in the Reagan administration. And so the origin of this document is really tied with the darkest times and ideas of the Cold War. And it was walked back from there by generals. And nowhere is there any kind of statesman-like understanding of the world as it is today and the existential issues facing humankind, any no kind of human solidarity or diplomacy. It's just all war all the time. It's a very relatively narrow echo chamber that produces this kind of document. You know, the people have a military background. They go to military colleges. They listen to the same think tanks. They spend their time with each other, and they reinforce each other's ideas. And they're not going out into either party, really, into understanding what the climate scientists are saying and what the needs of ordinary Americans are.
Well, we've always had Dr. Strangeloves in the military, but have the American people as a whole become inured to the prospect of nuclear annihilation and human extinction?
Geez, that's a scary idea, but it's an important question. To a certain extent, the apocalyptic imagination has become part of our mainstream zeitgeist through video games. Where I am in Albuquerque, there's a trampoline center which is called Fallout, and it's decorated on the inside with a mural showing a post-apocalyptic landscape of ruins where the city of Albuquerque used to be. So yes, I think we are getting numbed a little bit, and at the same time, we don't understand the reality of it all. Someone said to me recently that it's a little like if you've never been in a car accident of any kind, it may not seem real to you what can happen. And in a nuclear war is that many times over. We can't imagine what it would be like to have basically the sun appear over your city, something brighter than the sun at an altitude of a few hundred meters or a mile, burning everything up completely.
What would you like those of us who have not been numbed to the idea of being burnt to a cinder? What should we be doing? What should our response be?
We should be demanding dialogue with the Russians and to stop this ridiculous criminalization of diplomacy. We should be demanding a social contract that doesn't treat human beings like they're disposable. We should be demanding investments in renewable energy that create lots of jobs and career tracks for people, demand basically an end to the militarization of society and the beginning of a society based on solidarity and sustainability. We can do this in public in 100 different ways, from demonstrations at our congressional delegation offices, to letters to the editor, to study groups at churches and social organizations. It's hard for us. We can't even imagine giving up our big trucks for the way of life that we've had up to now. But, you know, we will if insist on trying to maintain a global empire. The world is very big. It's indomitable. We can't afford it. And the people who will pay the price are the people who have been paying the price all along. Only more so.
In general, folks seem to think that Donald Trump is more warlike and more likely to start a war than Barack Obama. Whether that's true or not, does that present a kind of opportunity for anti-war people to mobilize a public response to the U.S. war machine?
It does. It absolutely does. We can use the awareness of Donald Trump's volatility and the dominance of the military around him is an opportunity for us. But at the same time, we mustn't be naive and think that a person like Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, for that matter, would be some kind of peacenik. Many of us were very concerned about Mrs. Clinton and her methodical, imperial, Russophobic willingness to intervene. The destruction of Libya, that's on her desk. She did that. So we can't be naive about the mainstream Democratic Party and just make this into an anti-Trump campaign.
That was Greg Mello of the Los Alamos Study Group speaking from Albuquerque. Historian Peter Hudson, a professor of African American Studies at the University of California in Los Angeles, has a new book that explores how U.S. banks destabilize the economies and governments of the Caribbean and Latin America. It's titled Bankers and Empire: How Wall Street Colonized the Caribbean. Dr. Deborah Thomas is a professor of anthropology and Africana studies at the University of Pennsylvania. She was on hand for a coming out event at UCLA for Dr. Hudson's book.
Typically, when we think about imperialism in the 19th and 20th century Caribbean, we think about American companies like United Fruit, or we think about the construction of U.S. bases as World War II dragged on, or we think about the Cold War and the various dimensions of covert intervention throughout the region. And when we talk about the vectors through which we might track the infrastructures and ideologies regarding racial value, we usually center the institution of the New World Plantation. Peter, however, is asking us to look into the growing interest of the U.S. in the Caribbean and the ideological and material reproduction of white supremacy through the institution of banking, suggesting that this lens allows us to track important changes in imperialism globally. You'll hear some resonance with what Walter said too as I move forward. Bankers and Empire concerns itself with the late 19th and early 20th century internationalization of finance capital. It tackles, as a result, the expansion of the United States via Wall Street to its post-1898 sphere of influence, the Philippines, Puerto Rico, Cuba, Haiti, and elsewhere throughout Latin America and the Caribbean. Across the text, certain individuals appear and reappear as merchant and then commercial banks boom and bust in one location, then another, all the while followed by military intervention, attempts at financial regulation, agricultural collapse, and ultimately economic disaster. And throughout, these same individuals both espouse and solidify the scientific racism of the day that positioned natives of these territories as incapable of governing their own economic and political affairs, either due to their climactically inspired torpor or to their natural inferiority. Hudson's is thus a story of the fraught relations between empire and sovereignty through the lens of racial capital, one that instantiates what George Marcus Longfellow identified as one strategy through which anthropologists might conduct multi-sided research, follow the money. Following the money, in this case, joins the space of the American frontier and the dispossession of Native Americans to expansion overseas and the dispossession of formerly plantation-based workers and slaves. Hudson shows us the pan-Caribbean scope across which U.S. imperialist desire unfolded, transcending those European colonial divisions of language and supplanting the modern innovation of plantation-based, export-oriented monocrop agricultural production with modern finance capital, speculation, and debt. He draws attention to imperialism's masculinist dimensions, citing a New York Times article claiming that, quote, the lack of an American international bank was an affront to the U.S. manliness. He discusses the kerfuffles bankers raised in Cuba, Puerto Rico, Panama, Haiti, and the Dominican Republic regarding sovereignty in relation to the lack of banking legislation in many of these territories and in the United States. And he shows us how the U.S. government came to support the new infrastructures of colonialism using financial institutions as a, quote, conduit for colonial policy and financial and commercial diplomacy. At the same time, he highlights those moments when Wall Street clashed with Washington, making it clear that the relationship between economic and political interest was in no way seamless, as was also the case in late 19th century Great Britain. Ultimately, Hudson is interested, as he writes, in the infrastructures, institutions, and, quote, ideological and cultural rationales through which the Caribbean became the subject of the internationalizing and imperial efforts of Wall Street's banks, and at the same time fashioned the racial, economic, legal, and governmental terms through which the Caribbean was encountered, end quote. In this regard, the International Banking Corporation is shown to have mirrored extant racial divisions of labor in places like Panama, and to have solidified the sensibility that both Latin American and African-descended people were inefficient, languid, and personalistic, governed by, quote, backward Spanish modes of commerce, banking, and finance. These racist assessments were, in fact, shared by many observers who toured the Caribbean after the turn of the 20th century to write about the new U.S. sphere of interest, including authors like Harry Frank, who in his book Roaming Through the West Indies, which was an account of a more than 6 months' journey throughout the Caribbean, found Kingston, for example, to be the height of insolence, petty crime, disease, degeneracy, delinquency, and loose manners. Even the white officials were assessed as, quote, slow, antiquated, and precedence-ridden. In striking contrast, he argued, quote, to the young and bustling, if sometimes poorly informed, rulers of our own dependencies. Throughout his text, Frank articulated a certain faith, commonly held not only by bankers, but by other American observers at the time, including Zora Neale Hurston, that the future of the Caribbean lay with America. But of course, we wonder, what kind of future is this? With Bankers and Empire, Hudson shows us that these late 19th century financial stirrings would ultimately foreshadow longer histories of intervention and exploitation, with the economic crises of the 1930s, an era, he states, from which the region has never recovered. We have only to follow one figure who peripherally appears in Hudson's narrative, W.R. Grace, to see how true this statement is. Grace is briefly mentioned as having had construction interest in Haiti, But later he would appear in archives that I've been plumbing recently regarding covert intervention into the labor movement throughout the region. Grace, having made his initial fortune in the Peruvian guano industry in the mid-19th century, and later expanding that fortune through a shipping empire, again, the importance of shipping, relocated to the United States after the Civil War. There he went into airline development, as well as the industries in sugar, textiles, tin, and tungsten. And in 1945, J. Peter Grace took over the family businesses from his father, developed them as a chemical-based conglomerate, and shifted investments from South America toward the Caribbean. When Kennedy launched the Alliance for Progress, he brought in J. Peter Grace to head the Department of Commerce Committee, which sought to strengthen the capitalist sector in Latin America, which, unsurprisingly, ended up being strongly tied to U.S. imperialists. Eventually, he would have been involved in initiatives designed to control class conflict by limiting social reforms and strengthening Latin American militaries. And finally, J. Peter Grace would help to found the American Institute for Free Labor Development, the AIFLD, which through its involvement in trade union organization and its connections to CIA destabilization campaigns wreaked havoc on spaces through which Latin American and Caribbean people were trying to reimagine sovereignty on their own terms, including Jamaica. If Hudson is asking questions about the effect of the elaboration of U.S. finance capital on Western Hemispheric sovereignties, these are also the kinds of questions that have kept me up at night over the last 20 years. What does it mean to be human politically in the wake of the plantation? How have people confronted the unpredictable afterlives of colonialism and slavery, nationalism and state formation, in ways that perform not only a material but also an affective transformation? What does sovereignty feel like? My own specific obsessions have had to do with the temporal regimes to which post-colonial sovereignty projects have been tethered, how these have conditioned the affective states through which they're enacted and experienced, and how these have shaped the complex relationships among sovereignty, modern subjectivity, and the elaboration of the category human within a context whose foundational infrastructures were imperialism, colonization, and plantation-based slavery, regimes of citizenship and subjectivity that excluded non-European groups. Because we know that modern liberal democratic political arrangements have been designed to hide these foundational processes, that they've disguised the dehumanization of racism through the conceptual framework of perfectibility, we have asked questions about how people have both shaped and contested these processes, while also imagining something different. We might, therefore, ask the same kinds of questions about the narrative Hudson weaves. How did people negotiate these new forms of capital expansion and circulation? What practices of refusal might we read into this early 20th century moment? And what are the stakes of looking in and through what Robert Reed Farr has called new critical archives, archives that speak to other modes of claiming humanness and seeing the world, and that thus have the potential to rearrange the promises of liberalism and reconfigure the parameters of inclusion and exclusion? One of my favorite Anansi stories is the one in which the slave, brought up for discipline for having committed prairial larceny, defends himself by stating that if the fruit tree was Massa's property, and he is also Massa's property, then he could not be guilty because property cannot steal property. If we agree that a constitutive tension between the dominant logic of the plantation and its internal threat, the often millennial spaces within which enslaved persons maintained a conception of themselves as human rather than as property, then it is this tension that would also suffuse new iterations of racial capitalism, and that would ultimately shape the relationship between the national and the popular in relation to struggles over sovereignty. This is a tension that must be engaged by attending both to the movements of capital, the emergence and collapse of institutional infrastructures, and the development of regulatory policies, and to the realm of everyday practice. This dual focus allows an apprehension of the dynamics of perceived threats to the continuation of imperial practice over time, and therefore of the ways these threats are generated by and simultaneously produce the practices that refuse the forms of sovereignty and white supremacy. Bankers and Empire is a beautiful, innovative, angry, and impeccably researched text. And for me, it's also a classically historical text. The theoretical force of the book is embedded in its storytelling. The narrator never makes an explicit appearance. The storyline bobs and weaves, inciting us to follow, but never directly leading. Given that Hudson was trained in an American Studies department, I'm interested in this because it raises broader questions. How do different disciplinary lenses influence the stories we tell and the ways in which we tell them? What are the infrastructures that continue to shape our confidence in the approaches we develop? How may we transcend them? So this is all, again, fodder for your next book. But now that this story has been told, and been told so eloquently, it'll become part of our common sense. There's a Jamaican phrase, which I'm sure is British, but the mind, once to a new idea exposed, can never revert to its former shape. And that's, I feel like this is one of those crystallizations. It's an impossible to unthink dimension of our ever-deepening understanding of the long American century, one in which both everything and nothing is changed, and one in which the Caribbean remains central to the innovations of modernity.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.